The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Tom Clark, and this is Politics Weekly. After a summer of blazing riots on the streets, war in North Africa, and financial meltdown in Europe, even before today's spike in unemployment, there's only one issue that preoccupies politicians at the moment. And guess what? It's their own jobs. As the political map is redrawn, even some members of the cabinet might be searching around for a new seat by the time of the next election. We'll also be previewing the party conference season, looking forward to those annual jamborees that are no longer by the seaside. The Lib Dems are first up this weekend. Joining me for the start of the new season are Michael White, who's in Westminster, and here with me in King's Cross in the studio are Julian Glover and Nick Cohen. Back at the height of the expenses crisis, David Cameron raised an easy cheer with a call for less MPs. It doesn't look quite so easy now. He's left managing the consequences. This week, the Boundary Commission published the new political map for England, and there'll be fewer seats that are drawn on strictly equalised lines. Only a tiny minority of seats will remain as they are, and quite a number will be abolished entirely. And a totally redrawn political map, Julian, means an awful lot of worried MPs.
Yes, I mean, if you were in Westminster this week, all you had to say to every MP was, so what's your boundaries like? And they would tell you in great detail their fears or their hopes or their secret joy that they've been given a safe seat. It's sort of two elements to this. One is a terms and conditions, almost selfish feeling of MPs, just what's my future going to be like? Mm-hmm. The other is a wider question of the Constitution. Is it fair? Are these boundaries going to represent the people in the seats? Are they arbitrarily designed? Do they break up communities? Do they rig the election in favour of the Conservative Party? Some Labour MPs think the Tories are only doing this because of the electoral advantage, and there's a bit of truth to that. But then the system used to be biased in Labour's favour. So there's a serious constitutional element, and then there's a personal fear of everybody's job. And, of course, the personal fear dominated at the beginning.
And the personal fear, Nick, is probably also going to be the thing that will give David Cameron a real headache, isn't it? Because if there's a load of MPs who can't see a future sitting within their existing constituency, they're going to need to play to the gallery to try and get selected elsewhere, aren't they?
Well, indeed. And remember that there are lots of Conservative MPs who are expecting to be in government, to have ministerial jobs, who have been sidelined already because of the coalition deal. I think they've got some arguments on their side. I mean, England, not Britain, but England, has a great democratic deficit. We don't have an elected second chamber. Local government in England, not Scotland and Wales, with devolved assemblies, but in England, is terribly weak. And your MP is sort of all you have. And you're going to reduce the number of MPs. You're going to be increasing the caseload on the remaining MPs who are already doing ridiculously local, dealing with ridiculously small local issues because of the weakness of local government. In fact, there is no English Parliament. It just seems a rather odd thing to do.
If we had a member of the government here, what they'd say is, well, you know, from the times of the Chartists, people have said there should be equal number of people in each seats, and they're just...
Yeah, but you don't have to do that by cutting the number of seats in Britain. You could, if you wanted to, speed up the process by which the census is translated into parliamentary boundaries. It takes a very, very long time. You could remove some of the long appeal processes. You could do that far quicker. I mean, cutting the number of seats doesn't equate with the Chartist demands. They ask for equal seats, not for perhaps too few seats.
OK, and so, Mike, what do you think? I mean, you wrote a piece saying you're a bit worried about cutting back on the number of MPs, I think.
Well, Nick Cohen has touched upon the point in a general sense about what he called the democratic deficit in England, but there's an accountability deficit at Westminster. This, of course, as people have said, arose from two things. One is the coalition deal, but before that, this sort of great breast-beating which followed the MPs' expenses scandal, and people who used to be in favour of, I don't know, nationalisation of state industries, basic industries as a panacea for Britain's politics, have to some extent moved over to constitutional reform as a panacea, and they all thrashed around and said we must have single transferable vote. Well, we didn't get a referendum on that. We got the referendum on the alternative vote, which might have made the election results even less proportionate. And as part of the deal, we got this cut from 600 to 650. The Lib Dems, in their manifesto, as it was pointed out to me, actually proposed STV plus as many as 150 MPs cut down to 500. And they ended up with 50 because they thought the coalition partners, that would damage Labour more than it would damage either of them. And a Tory MP said to me this week, rather frustrated, the Boundary Commission has bent over backwards to be annoying to all of us, and we Tory MPs are more upset than we expected to be. But the other point, which I think hasn't been made, is the fact that if you have fewer MPs but you don't have fewer ministers, then the talent pool for select committees, chairmanships and all sorts of things, of holding ministers to account, that's one of Parliament's primary jobs, is thereby diminished. You've got fewer MPs around, fewer backbenchers to do their job. So it seemed to me a sort of knee-jerk response, a bit of expediency, a bit of sort of ill-considered reformism, try and save a few bob, which hasn't been thought through and is going to waste a huge amount of time.
Oh, we mustn't be too nostalgic about 650 as some constitutionally perfect number. It's a number that has varied with most recent boundary changes.
It's usually been higher. A hundred years ago, it was much higher.
Yes, and we don't look back 100 years ago and say that was a high point of democracy. I think it's completely right that there should be fewer ministers as well, and I hope those will be cut next. I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with 600, and nor does The Guardian, which in a leader this week backed that number. But there is a case to be made that reducing MPs will at times up the caseload for some people. Many, many MPs in the House of Commons in this Parliament and ones before have served more constituents than they will under this new boundary. So I don't think 76,000 is a number that is unworkable. It's important the boundaries are fair. The English Boundary Commission is pretty independent. It's listened to parties a bit in the process. It's upset people. If it's upset everybody, that's a sign it's doing its job well. I think we mustn't overindulge the anxiety of MPs, and I've got lots of friends whose seats are changing and I feel sorry for them, but we mustn't overindulge their anxieties as some wider problem facing the nation. There are many, many greater things. What matters is that the election result is roughly honest, that the boundaries are roughly equal, that MPs are free to speak out, and none of these things are going to be changed by altering boundaries.
But isn't there a real problem about just the artificiality of some of the communities that will be voting? I mean, you've got half an acknowledgement of this because lots of the islands, the Western Isles, Orkney and Shetland and so on, and the Isle of Wight indeed, are going to have special provision. But if you're in some sort of area that's now got a very sprawling and weird constituency, maybe with two local papers, two different councils for the MPs who nowadays we expect to do lots of social work as well to liaise with, isn't there just a kind of worry that the political process won't work as well and the social work bit of
what there is a worry about it, and you know, in certain examples I think there are problems. Lambeth is going to have six different MPs touching on the borough, and that's pretty tough. Lambeth needs holding to account by its local MPs. I think generally we had some pretty odd seats in the old Parliament too. We shouldn't exaggerate the strong ties every MP had to their community, or indeed the fact that everybody in Britain... It's funny listening to political class. You sometimes think everybody in Britain takes their identity from political structures, and so the nature of their local council is what they really hold dear in their lives, or the fact that their local MP has got a certain title to their constituents. It would be nice if that was true. I don't think it is true. I don't think it's been true before. Maybe this won't improve it, but I don't think this is the first time we've had that problem.
Yeah, I'm a loyal Kirk Lees man, first and foremost, myself. But, Nick... the oddity here is that there are other things that the Lib Dems in particular, but even the Tories, are quite keen on bringing in more elected representatives. Think of the elected police chiefs. Mm-hmm. Aren't you getting rid of one set of politicians with the one hand and then creating a load of others with the other?
Well, I mean, I know Lib Dems, I sort of give up trying to understand them, really. I mean, they had that ridiculous... What was it called? The electoral system? I've forgotten what it was already. Biggest vote in the...
alternative
vote, biggest vote ever. An entire system no one actually believes in. Roy Jenkins said could actually produce even more unrepresentative parliaments. But they go with that. They don't go in the coalition deals from the elected House of Lords. The real problem in England, not in Scotland and Wales, the real problem is the weakness of local democracy. The fact that you cannot get together with your neighbours and try and organise a campaign locally that would have the power and resources to, for instance, change the schooling or hold the NHS to account.
I'm not sure having more MPs is going to strengthen local government. And, you know, with his tongue in his cheek
MPs
to avoid answering the question a bit in Prime Minister's questions, Cameron did say, you know, I'm unusual in believing that a certain issue that was raised is entirely a matter for local government and not something for me. Well, it's important that that's said seriously by ministers and repeatedly, and beyond that, that the media then start agreeing. Because one of the problems we have in the political system is not just that politicians want to interfere in everything, and God knows they do, but the media then says, when is the Home Secretary going to resign because something terrible has happened? Or when is the Education Secretary going to intervene? And we have a constant culture which is shaped much, much, much by the press to demand politicians at the top step in and fix things and announce a task force. And it is a wider problem than just a weakness of local government. The weakness of local government is often a consequence of the way we treat localism.
Well, if Cameron was serious about localism, he would give more tax rating power to local councils. He's not doing any of these things.
Well, one of the things he has done, and the coalition has done, which Labour did not, is to remove the ring fencing of most money that goes to local government. So, for instance,
and most of the money,
and no, not most of the money on Sure Start. The funding for Sure Start has more or less continued. Many local councils have decided not to spend the money on Sure Start. Hence, a huge media and political hue and cry saying, why is local government not supporting Sure Start? Well, it's because some councils decided that Sure Start wasn't what they wanted. That should be a decision for local government. It shouldn't be a decision for central government. And yet we constantly hear from the Labour Party in the House of Commons, quite fairly, when will the government guarantee no Sure Start centre shuts? Well, they can't if they trust local government to make the decision. Some local councils might not want Sure Start.
Well, one thing's for sure, which is in the next few weeks, politicians of all parties are going to be looking for some fairly grandstanding types of announcements to make, and that's because they've all got their conferences coming up. We've already had the Greens and UKIP, but next week the serious stuff starts. We'll be tracking the big speeches and the gossip from the conferences. But let's first of all have a quick look at the cross-cutting issues. Mike, the economy really, particularly with the new unemployment figures, should be the issue that's dominating, but you get the sense that the riots might mean that it won't be.
Well, the riots lend themselves to more neat and compact and facile solutions. We can all get morally indignant. We all think we know what happened. We have different views as to what happened, but we all pretty confident we know what happened. Whereas the economic events are very much beyond our control. Those within our control, again, the lines have clearly drawn between what you might call the Keynesians and the Hayekites, between the fiscal consolidators and the people who say the last thing we want is to cut back when demand is so weak and growth is so weak. But most of the drama is taking place beyond our shores, at least at the moment, certainly this week in the Eurozone again, last week in America, where Obama threw the gauntlet down in a Keynesian position for pumping more demand into the economy. Ours is a bit of a sideshow at the moment. Perhaps we ought to be grateful for that.
And do you think that might play to David Cameron's advantage, because it gets back onto the sort of broken society terrain where he feels more comfortable, perhaps?
Well, I'm not sure that I've heard him use the phrase broken society so much lately. A lot of his colleagues don't like it. I don't like it myself. It's a bit glib. There is certain sections in the community, what we sometimes call the underclass, so visible during the looting in August, who are in big trouble for all sorts of deep-seated reasons, ranging from poor health and education, joblessness, generational joblessness. We know about them, but most of society isn't broken. Most of society does pretty well in what are currently pretty difficult circumstances for many people.
It's sort of slightly given way the broken society as a whole, hasn't it, to parts of our society broken over this summer.
It's funny, as soon as the Tories took charge with the Lib Dems, they stopped saying everything was wrong and just bits of it were wrong and bits of the inheritance. I mean, I think at conference the economy is going to be more than a background, and I think the riots, perhaps, which seemed like they would be the thing that conference would be about, won't be. There hasn't been a constant outbreak of riots through the summer. There's been a political response, which has been partly to challenge the police. There's all sorts of things to discuss there. All the leaders will give speeches trying to use the word responsibility and as their word, and will claim that the other parties are irresponsible, and that battle will no doubt take place. I think there's going to be a huge amount of fear about the economy. The Labour Party is anxious, A, about the state of the economy, B, about the government's policies, and C, about the public's complete lack of interest in the Labour Party's answers. And the polling this week should worry Labour, the Conservative Party, and the Chancellor appear to be ahead on the economy, and yet the Labour Party feels that that's extraordinary, because they think that what the government's doing is wrong. So the Labour Party has a chance in this conference season to get its message over. I suspect they'll fail. The Conservative Party needs to reassure people that times are tough, but this is the world's fault, and hope they don't remember that that's exactly what Gordon Brown used to say, and they mocked it. And the Liberal Democrats, as we saw with the speech Nick Clegg gave this week, are trying to say, yes, we're tough, yes, we believe in austerity, we're keeping Britain safe from the immediate pressures happening in other places, but we're the part of the government that believes in activism doing things. And Nick Clegg's speech had a few things in it, but he struggled a bit, apart from saying he was sort of going to shake the tree and get existing programmes to happen faster. He really struggled to find anything new to say, because the policies are set, they're not about to change. And we'll either see if they're right or wrong. The government still thinks it's a gamble that'll pay off in the end. If it starts to go really wrong by Christmas, goodness knows what will happen.
Which do you think the speeches to really watch out for are? I mean, if Julian's right and the economy really is as central as anything else, do you think we'll be almost watching the kind of balls and
Yes, I agree with that, yeah. It could be like the Conservative Party conference in 2008, when in the middle of it all Lehman Brothers crashed. I remember turning to a colleague from yours, from The Guardian, saying, well, this is the end of our world. Things are going to change pretty quickly now. And the way the highly irresponsible brinkmanship between Germany and Greece is going, there could be a full-scale euro crisis in the middle of, you know, when George Osborne or Ed Balls is about to take the platform. It's going to be very, very hard to ignore. I mean, I'm wondering with Cameron in particular, and the other leaders, in a funny way, the best speeches that have been made since the crash haven't been made by a politician. They've been made by Mervyn King, who, whenever he gets a public platform, tries to level with the public. He tries to say, look, you are going to have the biggest fall in living standards since the 1920s. He even went to the TUC and said, I fully understand your anger. It's not your members' fault. None of this is your members' fault. I wonder if some of the past political leaders would try a bit more of just laying out how tough things are, how there's not really end in sight, and what they intend to do about it.
Mervyn King isn't standing for election.
Well, indeed,
he doesn't have to get elected just as well, because the one person who could have deselected him, we learned from his memoirs, Alistair Darling, nearly did a couple of years ago. He thought it's completely useless at the start of the crisis. And Sir Mervyn has aligned himself in the last couple of years very closely with the deficit hawks in the Conservative Party. So we'll see how it goes. But since growth prospects seem to be being squeezed out of the British economy by our own efforts and by the retrenchment across much of the wider world, if you take a Keynesian view that active government intervention is part of what a modern state does, this is all extremely disturbing. And what we might be looking at, we're beginning to see it already in countries like Brazil and even Switzerland, heaven forbid, this sort of retreat into beggar my neighbour protectionism, which would be really scary, but would be entirely consistent with what happened on the second dip of the Great Depression of 1929, 33, 34.
Do you think, Mike, that the problem, though, is that this generation of 40-something leaders that we've got, just raised in the age of Tony Blair and kind of congenitally upbeat almost in the rhetoric. Osborne's tried the cupboard is bare kind of line a couple of years ago. But can you imagine, I don't know, Nick Clegg standing up and sort of saying, I'm sorry, it's really bad and it's going to get worse?
Well, in Clegg's speech this week, although he did say, yes, we must get capital projects on the go, he also said, we've really got to bear down on costs and ministries which have overspends which weren't budgeted for. We're not going to bail them out. You know, we've got to bear down on these costs every day. Francis Moore, at a speech I attended at Westminster this week, going on about the need to, you know, we're lucky we had a sale of Treasury bonds during the week, which went very well, low interest rates. Thank goodness we're not in the position of Greece. Well, of course, we never were in the position of Greece. And then you say, well, that's fine, Mr. Maud. The operation was a great success. We've kept up market confidence, but the patient appears to be dying. Don't you worry about demand being taken out of the economy by your cuts? And he said, you know, if we lose the confidence of the markets, you won't have seen nothing yet in terms of demand taken out of the economy. It's a pretty tightrope. Both major parties walk along cuts and economic stimulus. Obama has tilted back, as we said the other day, towards economic stimulus, and he's got a lot of good people supporting him. But, of course, he's got enormous resistance in the US Congress. It's very scary, the lack of coherent political leadership on both sides of the channel.
Chilling as all of that is, I wonder if I can just bring it back to the superficial froth of politics for a minute, Julian, and ask, do you think that there's a problem here that the kind of Keynesians have got compared to the other lot on the economy, which is it's just so much harder and more complicated. They talk about aggregate demand and stuff. The language about every family in the country is tightening its belt and now government has to do the same thing has a simplicity and therefore a compelling quality maybe that the other side of the argument doesn't.
It has a compelling quality in that it convinces me. I think it's been very valuable for this country to make it clear that it is going to contain its deficit, that it is reducing it under a controlled programme. It hasn't done it any more quickly than the Labour Party did in the 1970s. Spending falling is falling in real terms, in absolute terms, in cash terms, it's going up. This is not complete madness. It is also not greatly in scale larger than what would have happened under Alistair Darling. It is larger, and
that's
there is
correct.
A gap.
All
but
of that's correct.
There is
a gap. Still
a
problem.
But of course, but I was going to go on to that. I think so. It is very important to remember that one of the things that's discussed in politics is not cuts or no cuts, and that's the language we often get, but Alistair Darling's level of cuts or George Osborne's level, and is the gap between those two the determinant of the growth rate in the economy? And I would think probably not, but I don't actually believe had Labour won, they would have stuck to the Darling level, and I think we'd be in a complete crisis over trying to sell our debt at the moment. But nonetheless, the paradox of all this is that there is a lot of money sloshing around which doesn't find a home, and that's one of the reasons Britain's Treasury yields are going down to about 2.2% at the moment. Businesses, private sector businesses, have built up quite large cash reserves. Individuals, at least individuals with savings, have got cash which they can't get decent returns on. There is money in the world, not just in China and India and all of the growth parts of Asia. There's money in Europe that needs to find places where it can get a decent return if it's vaguely confident the money won't just be blown away. So what the government has to do, and it has to be done across Europe, it has to be done across the world, and it's extremely hard to do, is to find ways to get people to invest their cash into things that will generate economic growth and to give them the trust and the return that that investment is a good thing. So the Keynesians would write and say, well, that means we really ought to be borrowing a lot more and spending a lot more.
Building bridges or something.
And building bridges or building motorways or whatever. The government would say, well, that's why they're easing planning controls. They're trying to get that kind of thing going. The great challenge is if the government simply said, as parts of the left would like, we're going to borrow a lot more cash and actually undo cuts, give money to public sector workers, I don't think the government will be borrowing money cheaply anymore, and nor do I think that that is the best form of stimulus. I don't either agree wholly with the Tory right that simply says, well, we should just cut taxes and that will produce growth.
Julian is sort of undermining himself without realising it.
I am aware I'm undermining myself.
It's perfectly true that businesses, including British businesses, are just sitting on cash. And were sitting on cash before the crash. They were not investing in Britain because they saw growing unemployment, growing indebtedness, employment for many people being part-time rather than full-time. Unless you have some kind of Keynesian view that says only the government can break this kind of circle of design, this circle of decline, it strikes me as rather hopeless position this government's entered in, where yes, they're in deficit reduction strategy, and yes, I agree with Julian to some extent. Labour would have done the same, but there is no urgency about them. This goes back to your point, I think, about a generation of politicians who grew up during the longest boom in British history from 1992 to 2008. Who thought that Tony Blair's world was the only world, and then being confronted with a much harder world. Even if you stayed within George Osborne's spending limits, you could do quite a lot. You could say, we're taking money from often quite popular causes, and moving it over into capital investment. You see them all standing very tough, as Michael was describing with Francis Maude, on deficit reduction. You don't see them thinking about how on earth this country is going to make a living in the future, about saying, look, this crisis, the way we've all got this crisis wrong, is thinking, OK, there's a crash, and then it's over, and then we come back again. It's not, it's a rolling crisis. And thinking, well, you know, we need to start, I would say, capital projects, building houses, trying to get some kind of employment and stability back into the economy.
I agree with that, and it's not all to be done directly through central government. One of the things that's difficult about this crisis and different about this crisis is that it is a problem caused by government as well as potentially solved by it. Sovereign debt is a government thing.
Sovereign debt came because the private sector, your deregulated private sector, crashed and the government
Think Greece has a particularly deregulated private sector. Last time I looked, the problem with Greece was it has an incredibly overindulged public sector, and it continues to do so, and it has no lively private sector economy. If Greece had a decent economy, it wouldn't have a problem it has today. It has too big a government. And that has been a problem across Europe. This is not a problem only of the private sector. Vince Cable, who I feel constantly disappointed by his failure to talk about exactly the kind of things you've just talked about. I mean, an example of what I think is good is Crossrail has just issued a £600 million bond at slightly over government rates, which will go towards building a necessary railway in London, funded partly by the markets, encouraged by the government. That is the kind of model of what we need, and that's the kind of borrowing we need. Not borrowing to pay welfare benefits, not borrowing just to give public sector workers a pay rise, but borrowing to do things. Very, very good idea. Borrowing for things with a return. But this is not something where government is entirely innocent. Vince Cable predicted at the very start of all of this in his books that it was going to be a private sector debt crisis that caused the crash. Well, the private sector debt crisis might cause the crash at some point. We haven't had that in Britain yet. We've had public sector debt. That was the thing we didn't expect. That's what's so difficult and strange about this crisis.
Okay, we'll just have to veer it away from Macroeconomics Weekly for a moment. Julian mentioned Vince Cable there, Mike. Last year, he gave a very different speech at the Lib Dem conference from Nick Clegg. He sort of called them comrades and talked about how they were a rather different bunch from the Conservatives. This year, the potential for a split in the third party, you'd have thought, after the AV referendum and everything that's passed under the bridge since, would be much greater.
It's funny how the recriminations over the AV disappointment, as I will call it, seems to have disappeared. Others may correct me. I've not heard a lot about it lately. Vince Cable, of course, very careful at the conference last year in Liverpool not to get involved in the Murdoch business and then, you know, spill the beans to those two Daily Telegraph reporters to pretending to be constituents. So his share price has been very damaged in the last year. He's bouncing back. He's got more or less aligned with George Osborne on the need to ring fence the retail and investment sides of the banking industry. Pretty feeble compromise. They're both behind it. And now we read that although the NHS will be debated at the conference, there won't actually be a vote on it. In other words, the party leadership will try and stick by the compromises it got via the Future Forums negotiation, which modified some oddities of Andrew Lansley's enormous, unwieldy and slightly pointless health reform bill.
Sounds a bit New Labour, doesn't it? That kind of conference management, Nick?
My impression is, and I haven't heard anyone complaining about loss of AV. I mean, I could hardly complain. I've forgotten what it was. My impression is there's a bit less pressure on the Lib Dem leadership. They took such a battering after they went into power for Tories that people got a bit tired of kicking them and feeling it's a bit unsporting to keep on kicking them.
You're talking about the media, really, aren't you?
Well, yeah, also sort of disillusioned ex-voters or disillusioned still supporters.
Tuition fees.
Yeah, but I'm saying after that, Mike, it all just seems to have calmed down a bit around Nick Clegg. And perhaps he's not under the same pressure he was, say 6-9 months ago.
Yeah, that's right, Julian.
Yeah, I think the internal pressure is that they're wary of him. They're not going to do any great rebellions. There'll be some showy stuff at conference. You know, vote on drugs will probably get written up. On the NHS, I think there won't be a vote, but there'll be lots of speeches on the floor saying, isn't it terrible there isn't a vote? And that will be a problem, but not a disaster for them. The comfort for the leadership on that is that the people who championed the deal Nick Clegg reached are now the same people who say the deal wasn't any good, and he feels that they're reneging on that. As for the public, well, I think I was talking to one Lib Dem yesterday. They kind of feel that there isn't much going to go on. The government has set out its agenda. The public are unhappy. They're not desperately interested in individual party politics or individual party leaders. They feel things are quite bad. They're anxious about the future. They're not sure they trust anybody who tells them the future is going to get better. And we're in this interim period, which we may be for several years, in which we just watch and wait while the public aren't too engaged in politics. And then I think by 2013, you know, assuming the world economy continues in some form, politics will come back a bit and we'll start to see real trouble for the leadership at the Lib Dem conference as they try and define themselves before the next election. Labour will start to be interesting again because it might be the government quite soon, and Cameron will be under pressure from the Tory right. I think this year it's almost just a sort of on hold. So maybe it'll be very boring.
So don't tune in, please, for the next three Politics Weekly, because it's
next 3 years even.
Yes. Or maybe even the next 3 years. Good God. Well, despite Julian's gloom about the boring times ahead, we will be back next week and you can tune in if you think it's worth it. There's going to be special podcasts covering business and covering politics from the three conferences, and there'll be lots on guardian.co.uk/politics. My thanks though now to Michael White, to Julian Glover and to Nick Cohen. The producer was Matt Hill. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.